Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for October 14th, 2012. I'm your host, David McLaughlin, and joining me each and every week, welcome Catherine Smith.
Hello, happy Pride, everyone.
And welcome Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
Yes, well, big show tonight. We are going to have a guest in the second half hour, Steve Oppenheimer, who is running for the Georgia Public Service Commission, who I guess kind of shocked the political state, if you will, by outraising the GOP incumbent. He's going to be our guest in the second half hour. But before then, we're just going to talk about all kind of topics, both national and southern, until then. And let's just start right out with the presidential race. I guess the first part of the week was probably the worst week of polling for the president, the best week for Mitt Romney, and then the vice presidential debate, which the vice president did, you know, obviously put up more fight than the president, and I guess most would say did better. But the polling didn't directly move, but then this weekend, and we'll get into it, has shown much better polling information than early in the week. Tim, where do you think we stand right now?
Well, we are close. I'd say they're within a point and a half of each other, depending on who you believe. There are probably 12 states with a margin under 4 points. So it's anybody's race right now, David. The first debate definitely moved the race some, maybe by 4 or 5 points. I don't think there's any doubt of that. But seems like the bleeding stopped and some nervous Democrats, got their feet back on the ground a little bit when Sheriff Joe came to the rescue.
Yeah, well, and it's funny you mentioned Sheriff Joe because I was thinking of another Sheriff Joe in Arizona who may be coming to our rescue unwittingly. And that's
really.
We'll get to that later. Catherine, I think Tim is talking about the national polls, which have not been as good. But then if you look at state by state, knowing Ohio is huge, it's not been quite as grim. Where do you see it?
Well, you know, I think we all expected the polls to tighten up the closer we get to the election. And certainly the president's performance in the first debate was not as good as we all hoped. I think it's expected that the polls will tighten. We have two more debates, and hopefully he'll be on his game in those two, and maybe they'll move again towards the president. But 538, the 538 poll has changed considerably. From, what he was at, 84% chance of winning, and now it's at 69.
Yeah.
So
it's been a huge move, and it kind of scares me because it's real. I will say this. The national number is problematic, but knowing that a lot of these gains have come because Romney has gained in states he was already going to win. He's just increased his margin.
Tim,
Ohio
is
huge. In Ohio, the poll came out today from Public Policy Polling, and he's up, 6 points today? And he's up over 50.
It was 5, and no,
he's
not.
He's up and people have voted. Is what?
He's not 5 points ahead in Ohio. He's not even 2 points ahead in Ohio.
Well, no, he's not, Tim. He's actually way more than that, because if you look among voters that have voted, and I'm trying to get to this thing, his lead among voters that have voted is in 30 points. I'm trying to find the voters that have already voted. It's huge advantage. And I think that's something that here it is.
Well,
seven 56 to 24 margin among voters who have already voted. Now, that's not by any means going to be the final margin, but if you know how Democratic politics works, particularly with some of the voters that are harder to get to the polls, if you can go ahead and just put them in the bank and then start doing voter targeting on a new set of voters, and you keep doing this and you keep doing this, you change the electorate and the makeup of it. And I think this is a huge advantage for the president, and it's actually shown nationwide. Huffington Post had a poll that showed, if you look nationwide, that the president's leading by 28 points. It's a Reuters poll among voters that voted. He leads 59 to 31. I'm trying to do my math in my head because I don't have the thing in front of me. I just don't think this voters that have already voted lead that he's building is anything to sleep on. Tim, tell me what
for one thing, I've seen polls that beg to differ, and Romney's people say definitely it's different, that they're out there doing the same thing, and they're sending voters to the polls in bigger numbers than John McCain ever did. That's how Obama ran up such a big win 4 years ago. He actually lost among voters who voted on Election Day in Ohio 4 years ago, but he ran up such a big early vote margin that he won that state by nearly 5 points. I don't know if he's going to have as big a gap this year, because the other campaign, who was caught flat-footed 4 years ago, is also trying to do the same thing. I don't know if they have as many field offices and as many people in the field, but they got to be doing better than McCain and them did, because they didn't do anything at all.
Well, I mean, I just tell you that if you look at what they say, I mean, this Reuters poll, and I think it's going to be an interesting one to keep up with, among early voters, it was just released today, and it shows, 59 to 31 lead. Now, that's nationwide. That could be a lot of voters in California and New York. I mean, I'm going to be fair the other way. If I'm talking about Texas and Nebraska for Romney, you got to talk about states the president's going to win. But on public policy's polling, it showed that we have a big lead among, voters, a bigger lead actually than nationally, among voters that voted in Ohio. The guy Michael McDonald, who studies this at George Washington University, I sent that article to you, Tim. It shows that we are doing better than we did last time in a lot of places. Because that AP article that actually talked about, Romney's campaign doing better, I just kind of trust this professor that studies this thing more than I do some AP article that quotes somebody from the Romney campaign. Catherine, what do you think on early voting? What's your sense, or have you read some of the stuff we've read?
I heard a story on NPR the other day that contradicts what you're saying. So I think there's probably a lot of talk about what's going on and who's doing what. But if we have actual numbers of people and we can evaluate that, then, that's the best possible scenario. But, I think that, early voting hasn't started everywhere, and it starts in many places this coming week. In Georgia, it starts on Monday. I think in North Carolina, it starts on Thursday. So, we're just going to have to wait and see. I'm so glad that we're finally recognizing that we're paying attention to early voting, because I think the last couple of elections, not just the presidential, but the last couple of elections, we see a lot happening in the last, week of the election when, so many people have already voted. So I'm glad that the early voting is getting more attention, because, a lot of people, something happens at the end of the election, but they've already voted. A lot of money gets wasted in mailing and advertising those last few days when so many people have already voted. So I think that's a good change.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, a lot of the Democratic consultants I talked to, they have understood early voting, and they understand that you can actually get those rolls on a daily basis of voters that have already voted, and they know we don't have to do voter contact on them anymore. So then they start spending their time on other folks. and they get in more and more folks. And that's what I think is going to change this electorate to make it look more like 2008 in its composition. And that's going to be huge because they're just going to be able to push more voters and more voters. They're going to be – it's a smaller pool of people they have to drive to the polls at that point. And then they can also tell people, hey, the lines are not going to be as long at, you know, some of our precincts because there were, you know, a lot of these people have already voted. I think they're doing a better job. They learn from, you know, past patterns. Now, the Romney campaign may be trying to do more, but for whatever it's worth, Republican voters are usually just more consistent about going to the polls. So if you have a Republican voter that always shows up at the polls and then you have them vote absentee this time early, you didn't gain anything in the end. It's these voters that are harder to reach that, for whatever reason, tend to be more Democratic. Those are the ones you can move and will do more good. The Republican get-out-the-vote consultants just don't have as good a group to work with because their people are just a little more disciplined for whatever reason. Tim, I mean, do you see this as, you know, a factor?
Well, I do. The one thing I do think that also will be problematic for the president that they need to look at, and they need to work on this too. You talked about them wheeling and doing that after they got their early vote out. But I believe that Romney is going to run up a much bigger Election Day vote on Election Day itself than John McCain did. We're going to need these early voters to counteract what's going on. And, man, it's going to make some of these states very close. I'm sitting here looking at the real clear politics averages now, which I don't poo-poo because their track record is just almost spotless in past elections. And two things I see that really worry me is that Romney has opened up leads in both Florida and North Carolina of over 3 points. If that's true, the president has to stop him in Ohio. If he can stop him in Ohio, he's going to beat him. That's the state right now that is so important, is Ohio. Somebody in the campaign ought to be there every day now until the election is over. That's the key state. I've done decided that.
Oh, wow. Ohio is the key state. And then Iowa's also a very important state, given some other maps, if you will. And Iowa, the president's get-out-the-vote effort's doing well. I think really of the state that I actually saw numbers listed for, North Carolina's the only shortcoming. I've even seen news that says that Florida's not nearly as gone as one might think.
I didn't say it's gone. I just said he's behind by 3 points. That's what I said.
And then further complicating the map for Romney is a poll came out this weekend that showed the president leading. Now, that poll had a good many undecided still in it, but it also showed the U.S. Senate candidate leading. And I looked at the crosstabs, and I was like, was the composition wrong? The composition looked about right of who the electorate was. And the key thing I noticed is we're seeing on a lot of states that have high Latino populations, Latino voters are becoming nearly as Democratic as African-American voters.
Which state was
and
this?
That is huge.
Yeah, what state are you
Arizona
talking about?
Poll.
Arizona
poll.
Right, Arizona. You didn't mention the state. You just started talking about a state.
I'm sorry, Arizona. And it was a Rocky Mountain poll that came out this week. You talked about Sheriff Joe. Well, Sheriff Joe Carmona, what is his name out there?
Arpaia.
I don't know his
Arpaia
name. Arpaia. He, I think, is leading a lot of this charge. And, of course, the governor out there, they have, been so targeting of Hispanic voters. They've become very Democratic this year. And that may help in places like Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, and make the, you know, map a little tougher for Romney because, you know, if he loses Arizona, then another gain of a state that he got, you know, that's worth 10, 12 points, Arizona mitigates then. And so that's a new point to have to advertise, focus on. And so I think he finds a solution one place like a North Carolina or in Indiana. But if this becomes a problem, then his road is so much more narrow, he has to consider that.
It right now, he's a little over 5 points behind in Arizona. If that just holds true through Election Day and he loses that state by 5 points, we'll win that Senate race and we'll win congressional races down ballot all over that state, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
And that'll be huge. I mean, but the, I don't think Arizona's a state the president has to have, but it absolutely is. Romney has it.
Because we could use that Senate seat.
We can always, yeah, exactly. We need that Senate seat.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, we could use Senate seat. Sure, I'm just saying. But, well, there's even a chance for whatever reason that the president could lose and Richard Carmona, there's our Carmona, he wins that Senate seat. I'm kind of surprised, though. I thought when that Representative Flake of Arizona, who's the GOP candidate, he pushed out Gabby Giffords and helped her when she returned to the House for the State of the Union. I thought that was really going to give him some crossover appeal. It was a good message to send. And I'm surprised he's struggling as much as he has. And to me, that says that Arizona may follow New Mexico in its voting patterns. And then if Arizona's a growing state and it begins to vote like New Mexico, except it has more voters, that's not only going to complicate, you know, matters for the Republicans this year, that's going to complicate it for them going forward, because that's another Sun Belt state for them to lose. So, I mean, it's not in the South, but...
David, you and I have talked a lot about this presidential race, and I think I seem to be a little more looking at it as if Romney really, really, really could win this thing now than you do. Am I right?
Yeah, I feel like just at the end of the day, I just don't think he wins. There's something about him I just don't think that 50.1% of the electorate is going to go for. I just don't think incumbent that's done a good job, certainly on foreign policy and the economy. I still think if you see these polls, they blame Bush much more. I just don't see the president getting fired, if you will. And if you lose the election, you got fired. And I don't think he's going to get
fired. Here's why I think he can. Early in this campaign, the president's campaign specifically tried to do one thing, steer it away from being a referendum just on this president and making it a choice election. And it worked like a charm all year until they were face to face on that debate stage and 90 million people got to sit there and compare the two. And if I dropped off another planet and I'd watched both of them and didn't know anything about either one of them, I'd have said, well, Mitt Romney's my guy. That's why I think these polls got shaken up, is because people are moving a little bit and they're giving him a second look directly as a result of that debate. The president cannot repeat that performance Tuesday night. If he does,
yeah,
it might be Mitt Romney's to lose.
Well,
I agree with that. I think that the only thing Mitt Romney had to do in that debate was make himself look presidential, and he did.
Sure
did. He said more than that, but he made himself look presidential. And, I mean, I didn't think he did, but I think in general, the opinion was that he did, and I think that was really all he had to do. And he actually did more than that. So the expectations were exceeded. So that's and the president just had a bad night. I mean, he said that in an interview.
Yeah.
He had a bad night. But, you can't have a bad
night. And I'll say this. After 2004, I don't know what presidential's looking like, because I know somebody going, need some wood, doesn't look presidential. I don't know how that ever looked. But so it must have been, since he served 8 years as president. So I kind of wonder what presidential is like.
The difference being there, David, is that I think Bush 43 entered that debate with a much bigger and more solid lead than the president did this year. He lost about half of that lead after that first debate, and he should have. He was terrible. The president's his lead was a little bit softer. I think people were saying, you know, I'm not real happy with the president, but I'm just definitely, I don't like that Romney guy.
Well, the thing that I have hard time swallowing, if you will, is the fact that nothing was said in that debate either way that should have made people's opinions change.
It wasn't about what was said.
Wouldn't necessarily dislike him. It was all style. There was no substance that made anybody change.
That's because it's on television.
Two days later, talking about 8% unemployment, and the number goes down to 7.8. And it wasn't like the president got a lick of credit for doing what people have been harping on all this time. And it just doesn't make logical sense. And I think this weekend...
Oh, it's not about logic, though, David.
Polling, I think we're starting to see some logic come in. I think people in Ohio and Arizona, even that Georgia poll that showed the president down 8, he ain't going to win Georgia, but that 8-point poll, based on what we've been seeing in other places that are either national or swing states, it says that, to me, the president's starting to... You know, people are starting to look at this thing and go, well, why in the world did anybody leave him? There was nothing that Romney did to make people change the race. It was just that he, the president, was overly polite. And my fear is, though, is what will happen is if the president gets tougher, just like Joe Biden was, people are going to say he's mean and nasty and scared for his job and rude and everything else. And Romney's going to be passive and he'll still win because he'll change the rules. There's a wrestling manager who said, just when you think you got us beat, we change the rules. I think the rules are going to get changed on him because that's what the Republicans know how to do. Because to me, if you look, Paul Ryan and President Obama used the same debate strategy, and Mitt Romney and Joe Biden used much the same debate strategy. And the Republicans said Biden lost because he was rude. Well, so was Romney. At least have a set of rules that's consistent.
But you don't have a set of rules that's consistent. You have a set of rules that, because it's not really rules, it's judgment. It's, opinion.
Yeah.
And, of course, your opinion is going to favor your candidate. So Romney was strong. Romney was strong and presidential, and Biden was rude and unpleasant. I understand what you're saying, but I don't think we should be surprised. And I think we would play the game the same way.
David. The American people have a funny way on their own of deciding what's what. And you saw the polling from that first debate. It was a wipeout in most everybody's mind. Second debate, pretty iffy. I think CNN had Ryan winning by 4 points, and no one else did. CBS had Biden winning by 19 points and this and that. Yep. So Biden's strategy obviously worked. The president's strategy obviously did not. Don't matter what the other two guys did. If Obama had come to the dance and used half of those attack lines available to him and used opportunity when it arose during that debate, and it did, and he had taken care of business, we wouldn't be talking about any of this tonight because
that's right.
It'd still be a 5 or 6 point race, and this baby would just about be over.
Yeah, but here's a poll question I'd like to see. If the president can do one thing this week, win a debate or lower the unemployment rate by 0.4%, which do you want? I mean, he accomplished something that really should matter to his job, and it seemed to reflect nowhere in the polls. And that just to me is not logical. And I do, at the end of the day, believe the American people are more logical. And that's why
I think
that we're seeing some of these polls.
You're wrong. People do. The American people are not logical about these things. It's a very emotional. People have very emotional responses to our president and to the presidential elections, more so than congressional or Senate races or local races. It's very emotional. It's very they feel. I guess because, he's the leader and he's supposed to be an inspirational and a charismatic leader as well as being, good at his job. So I think that while there's a bit of logic in it, I think that to expect logic and facts to play a larger role than our emotional response is unfortunately not accurate.
She's right, and there's one reason why. Television.
Yeah.
In 1960, people that watched that debate thought John Kennedy won it. Those that listened to it on the radio scored it about even, maybe Nixon barely winning it. It was about perceptions, about what people saw on television. You've seen the pictures of Nixon and Kennedy side by side that night. Not only was Nixon wearing the wrong suit, but he had that infection, and he was sick, and he looked terrible. And perceptions on television is reality. Romney looked like the forceful, take charge kind of happy warrior, and the president looked sullen, distracted, and kind of browbeat a little bit. And people fed into that, David.
But wouldn't the 60 debate really prove both our points? Because who had the bigger, bolder, better ideas in 1960? John Kennedy did. Frankly,
yes.
Richard Nixon in 1970 or 68 and 72 had bigger, bolder, and better ideas than Mitt Romney. So I'm just saying, the guy put forth nothing the other night substantive. The only thing I heard, he was big per thing.
But John Kennedy himself later on told Ted Salinger that he credited that, especially that one particular debate, with his election as much as anything because, quote, I looked like Richard Nixon's equal that night. I looked, not that I presented facts that made me his equal, but I looked like it. Television is not about reality. It is about perceptions of reality. Willie Horton, the prisoners in the turnstile, the Bush commercial with the wolves in 2004, the Johnson commercial with the little girl picking flowers and the atomic weapon exploded. It's perceptions of reality, and that's what people fed into at that debate.
Well, that segues nicely into the next thing, talking about commercials that will be remembered from this campaign. I think very few will be, but I do think this past week one will be remembered. I don't know that it's going to move a lot of voters by any means. I think it was more enjoyed by the hardcore base than certainly a swing voter. But it was the Big Bird commercial, and in general, Big Bird has been very politicized. There was a poll done by Vanderbilt on Big Bird's approval rating, and he's approved by 30% more Democrats. His approval rating among Democrats is 85%, and Republicans is 35%. Now, talking about illogical, I just gave approval rating number to a bird puppet, and that's illogical. But nevertheless, there was this ad that came out. There was a minute version and a 30-second version saying, it wasn't Bernie Madoff and different Ken Lay and different Wall Street raiders that you watch out for. Knows it's Big Bird. He's not going to crack down on Wall Street. He's going to crack down Sesame Street. Now, this is a substantive thing that came out of the debate. And I noticed the president has two commercials based on the debate on what Mitt Romney says. Mitt Romney has zero on the president. I don't know why. I guess the president didn't give him anything to run on as far as the words he actually said. I think that's pretty telling. But, Catherine, how effective do you think this commercial is or is not? And secondly, should Big Bird be so politicized?
Well, I have a anecdote to say about that is today I had the pleasure of driving in the Atlanta Pride 2012 parade with my LGBT friends and allies. And the other day we thought, wouldn't it be great to have – we were riding with the Obama for America crew, and we were passing out buttons and stickers and signs and all kinds of stuff. And someone said, wouldn't it be great if we had Big Bird in the car? And we're all, like, wondering, well, where do we get a Big Bird costume? Well, someone got one and rode in the back of my convertible today, and we got – incredibly loud and, excited response. Everybody's like, oh, look, it's Big Bird. And everybody's, four more years, save Big Bird, So, I think that's just you know, it's just, like I said, it's anecdotal. But it was fun, and it was kind of a funny little trick, you know, to get some attention in the parade. But I am not of the generation that was raised on Sesame Street. You know, I've watched it a few times. It's not part of my cultural paradigm. But I love it. I think it's great. I think it's been really good for, you know, the generations that came after me. I do not think it should be politicized. And I think that I was disappointed that Romney did that. That Romney, well, first of all, it's a ridiculous suggestion that, you know, cutting, you know, the funding to public broadcasting is going to help the budget in any way, because it's like a, you know, one-tenth of one, you know, I mean, it's a teeny, teeny bit of the federal budget. And I think that, I don't think it should be, such a small thing should not be part of the big discussion about our spending, in my opinion. So, I don't think it should be politicized, but I you know, applaud the president and his team for coming up with this clever little commercial that really was intended for, you know, us, the inside politics people and the devoted fans of the president. So, you know, I thought it was cute and a good message, you know, not a bad message. So, but no, I don't think he should be politicized, but Romney started it, so.
Yeah, the only thing, if the Republicans were to win, then they could finish it, if you will, by cutting Sesame Street. I mean, they could, you know, if they were to get everything and make a big deal out of this, and I know they make a big deal out of this and the National Endowment for the Arts and Humanities and a few other things, if they were to take this and then say, okay, we're going to do in Sesame Street and PBS once and for all because of how this election played out, that'd be kind of a sad thing. And obviously, I mean, I don't know. I mean, these characters on Sesame Street don't have a political orientation. I doubt they have a sexual orientation to be in pride parades. Although, if you were going to have somebody, I would have invited Bert and Ernie because I've heard rumors. Tim, what do you think of this?
Well, Catherine was right. It was a limited ad buy, so the ad really didn't affect anything. It was just targeted to the base to fire us up a little bit. More Democrats, of course, do like Big Bird. Well, that's not surprising because more Democrats like PBS. Many conservatives view it as a liberal network. They view giving any taxpayer money to it. You know, they think that everything should sink or swim. You saw how they reacted to the auto bailouts and things like that. So I'm not surprised at all about this. And I really, in my heart of hearts, think there's no way, even in a Romney administration, that they could cut funding to PBS because of the makeup of the United States Senate. So.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's if they were to begin to win everything, they'd have to control the House, Senate, and Congress.
Yeah, they got to have 60 votes in the Senate. So,
well, I mean, that's if you know somebody's going to filibuster over that, and I don't know if that would be something given the agenda that would come down. They would filibuster on because I'll tell you that the Republican Senate and House is becoming more and more conservative. I mean, you just don't have less and less moderates because. You know, who's in the Senate? They've just gotten more and more conservative because of the Tea Party movement.
Yeah.
No, it was a limited ad buy, but it's one of those kind of commercials, I guess, that goes viral. Obviously, people can click on it real quickly on the Internet, which is becoming a bigger and bigger, mode of not transportation, but information to find things out. Well, I tell you, let's segue another time into our guest. Welcome back for the second time, running for Georgia Public Service Commission. I guess the top of the Democratic ticket statewide, that for the people that are only running the state, Mr. Steve Oppenheimer. Mr. Oppenheimer?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Hey, you're here on the kudzu vine.
Oh, yeah, awesome. Yeah, hey, good evening.
Well, Well, welcome back to the show. I guess one of your campaign advisors, Ted Terry, lined this up for you. Well, you kind of made news this past week when you outraised your Republican incumbent opponent in Georgia. Were you surprised by that, or did you – you've been on the phone and you just expected that to happen?
Well, we've been, working very hard for a long time building our base of support, and it goes well beyond the Democratic Party because the issues of the Georgia Public Service Commission really aren't red issues or blue issues. They're green issues. It's about how much Georgia families are spending on energy each month, what kind of bite that's taking out of their budget, and also in the big picture, it's what kind of energy jobs we'll have here in Georgia in the years to come to help us with the recovery.
Yes. Well, I can continue to ask you questions, but I don't want to be fair to my co-host, Tim and Catherine, and let them ask some questions, and I may come back around. Catherine, questions you have for Mr. Oppenheimer.
Hey, Mr. Oppenheimer. Thanks a lot for being on again tonight.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Just call me Steve.
Okay. Thanks, Steve. So you said that you're reaching out beyond the Democratic Party, obviously. Are you seeing a lot of contributions from Republicans or independents? Is it a pretty broad range of financial contributions as well?
Oh, yeah. So it certainly is. And the contributions are coming from folks. In a campaign like this, a lot of them come from friends and people that you've worked with and stuff over the years in the community. And we've always just been focused on issues and initiatives that brought us together where we didn't know whether I didn't know the other people were Democrat or Republican, and the same was them of me. It was just rather we agreed in what we were the outcome we were trying to produce, whether it was benefiting children's schools or middle schools or high schools or college students, or even working on energy initiatives these last 8 years. It really defied any kind of partisanship.
Well, that's good news. It's nice to know that something defies partisan politics.
Mm-hmm.
And so how is the campaign going? Are you, what's happening? I know I've seen you around a lot. You were at the Fulton Dems the other night. Is that the kind of stuff you're doing, going to meetings and community events, and is that sort of the focus of your campaign, or are you doing canvassing or all of it, or what?
Yeah, we're really kind of all of the above. We have visited many around the state at a lot of Democratic events, but we've also visited around the state at a lot of energy events, whether it is energy efficiency, renewable energy, or smart grid. Again, these are topics that really are green topics, that there's all kinds of people that are in these businesses because they see that this is where the 21st century jobs are going to be. And meeting energy demand and keeping it affordable for Georgia families is going to be a challenge. That in the last 5 years, our residential rates are up more than 25%. And we all feel that as homeowners, and it's the same is true of small businessmen or small business people, that those rates are also up 25%. A 5% a year increase is just not sustainable. We can't keep doing that every year when electricity's gone up nearly 25% and the consumer price index is only up 10%. It's just taking a bigger and bigger bite out of people's budgets. And everybody's looking for ways to innovate, whether it's energy efficiency and a number of other states like North Carolina and Arizona that for years have integrated an aggressive mix of renewable energy like solar and energy efficiency into their mix are seeing their rate increases slow down a bunch, whereas Georgia's increasing 5% a year. As other states I've mentioned are really only increasing 1.5% to 2.5% a year, more like inflation. So we've got real challenges here in Georgia.
I'm gonna go ahead and pass it over to Tim. Go ahead, Tim.
Yes, sir. Often during election years, the PSC races tend to be, shall I say, overshadowed by higher profile races. As you go around campaigning, do you find a good deal of voters that just simply do not know about your race?
Well, that's a pretty accurate assessment, and that's what our polling told us. And this is certainly a case that what you don't know can hurt you, because our polling also told us that when people realize it's the Public Service Commission that has been raising their electric rates at such a rapid rate, 25% in 5 years, and also made them responsible, the ratepayers responsible, for cost overruns at the nuclear plant without the utility having to share the risk and with a risk-sharing mechanism. People are upset about that and the fact that they're having to prepay for this nuclear plant well before they get any electricity from it. It's like having to pay all your mortgage interest before you ever move into your house.
You mentioned on your website, and I think you touched on this just a bit a minute ago, but I want to go back to it because it kind of surprised me. But you mentioned that Georgia has fallen behind just about every other southern state in energy sector job creation. Why exactly is that?
Well, that's due to the policy that when I'm on the commission, I'm going to be a full-time, hardworking commissioner for the people. There's two components to what the commission does. Two key components. One is, rate cases, reviewing rate cases and deciding if they're justified or not. But every 3 years, and next year in 2013, it's the three-year cycle, there's what's called a resource planning process that goes on between the Public Service Commission and the utility. And it's at that time where there's an opportunity to say, let's see, energy companies that are doing things the modern way are emphasizing utility scale energy efficiency, and they're also emphasizing renewable energy. And a recent study came out from American Efficient Economy Association and cited that Georgia was in a four-way tie for 43rd place among the 50 states for energy efficiency. There were only three states with less energy efficiency attainment. So that means we're not creating those good kind of energy efficiency jobs that would relate to, like in Atlanta, they're doing a big project called the Atlanta Better Buildings Challenge, where they're going to the goal is to upgrade 42 million square feet of office space. So in 10 years, it's saving 20% of the electricity usage and 20% of the water usage. Well, obviously, retrofitting that much square footage with energy efficiency, more efficient appliances, more efficient lighting, more efficient insulation, it's going to create a lot of jobs. And all the products that go into that kind of renovation all need to be manufactured somewhere. And we want to have that happening here in Georgia. And that's why we're falling behind. And we've got some great solar companies here in Georgia, but they're not doing that much bit of their business here in Georgia. They may be headquartered here because they were part of an incubator from Georgia Tech, which does a lot of creates a lot of applied engineers where they, you know, really do stuff to change society. But when we have a climate here that the regulations don't really aren't conducive to doing renewable energy and energy efficiency, they may be headquartered here, but they're doing their business in other states.
Wow. And I wanted to piggyback one question under that ties into it, and then I turn it over to David to finish this thing up. You've been talking a lot about efficiencies and how we can save energy, lower energy costs, but are there's been a rather prodigious population increase in Georgia in the last, you know, quarter of a century. Are the energy needs of this state keeping up with the population growth, or are we falling behind there as well?
No, I mean, one thing you can look at is Georgia has reliable electricity. You flip the switch, the light comes on. If there's some kind of emergency and you lose power, our power comes back on relatively quickly. We don't have brownouts. We don't have blackouts. So we have a very good system here, and we want to make it an even better system. And that's what the resource planning process would look to do, because we need to make it better, but we can't keep raising the cost of it 5% a year. So that's why we need to incorporate the modern ways of making and managing energy, so we can be doing serving more people with less energy. And, of course, as we get more people, then we'll need to grow and increase some plants. But actually, you know, we've got these nuclear reactors under construction now, and they're a $14 billion project that it's the largest capital construction project in Georgia ever. And they're already, according to the Independent Monitor, $1 billion over budget. Well, 5 years ago, Georgia Tech did a study and said, well, if we started emphasizing energy, utility-scale energy efficiency back in 2005, we wouldn't have needed to even build these plants. Yes, we would have still had to spend billions on energy efficiency, but we wouldn't be paying for these plants that then have extensive upkeep you know, really during this construction phase, it's a nervous moment here for the state of Georgia, because the last time we built two nuclear plants in the 1970s, they actually set out to build four nuclear plants, Vogtle 1, 2, 3, and 4, at a proposed cost of $660 million. 13 years later, they'd only completed Vogtle 1 and 2 for a cost of $8.9 billion. Or a 1,200% cost overrun that ended up coming back to the people. So it's really important now that people understand this race is something that impacts them directly. It is the only statewide race. It is at the top of the ballot immediately after the presidential race. So it's not buried deep in the ballot. Everybody understands this does impact them directly for years and years to come.
Well, as you were talking, you made me think of one more question, and I hope David doesn't mind me taking the liberty to ask it. We're talking about these nuclear power plants. They've been a sore spot with a lot of people because essentially – the taxpayers of this state were asked to pay for power and for plants that they don't yet even have. Has your opponent or anyone else down there ever given you a good reason as to why that is?
Well, I really don't think the people were asked. I think it was just worked out, you know, that was the way it was going to be. I mean, it was never on the ballot. It was never much of a public discussion. We just kind of found out after the case. But,
yeah, it was
facetious
with the ass part.
Yeah, okay. But, you know, the claims of the other party is that it's like, when you pay a mortgage over a period of years, you pay more interest up front than you do at the end. But you can't use that you can't use that analogy because you're at least in the house and living there. And I got to tell you, there are a lot of people. You know, Georgia right now, we are slipping. We are number eight in unemployment now. We've got the eighth greatest unemployment in the United States. And there are a lot of people living on the edge, and paying for the things that they have is hard enough. Paying for something they don't have is a burden that many can't carry. And as I go around and I talk to particularly senior citizens remember the history that the last plants took more than a decade to build and were 12 times over budget, they're like, I'm paying for something I'm never going to see.
Wow.
And younger people say, well, how do I know my company's not going to move me to another state? And I'm prepaying for this plant. So it's just something I think is wrong. And I never would have been in favor of it. And I never would have, as a commissioner, suggested to the legislature that that's what they push through.
Well, thank you, sir. And, David, I'm sorry I took up so much time. Back to you.
Oh, no problem. As long as you got good questions, which you did, that's what it's about. Well, Mr. Oppenheimer, if somebody's heard you tonight and they want to help you in these last few weeks of the campaign, how are some of the best ways to do that?
Well, the easiest way is to come to my website, which is steveforgeorgia.com. And register and get our updates. They can make contributions. We need help around the whole state with phone calls and canvassing. And we do about a weekly newsletter, and that would be great for folks to come to the website, sign up, get those updates. And, yeah, we are looking to get the message out, and the financial help is always appreciated. But joining our team and helping is appreciated, and contributions at any level absolutely make a difference.
Well, thanks again, Mr. Oppenheimer, for joining us on the Kudzu Vine.
Thank you.
My pleasure. All right, thank you, guys.
Thank you, sir.
Everybody, make sure everybody votes now.
That's right.
Take care. Okay.
Yes.
Bye.
Thank you.
Hi.
Well, one little topic we hadn't spoken of has been in the news, at least certainly in Tennessee, been kind of controversial. Congressman Scott Jarlius, and that probably is way mispronounced, Tim, if you know it, or Kathy, in Congress, is in a race against State Senator Eric Stewart. Well, it came out that about 12 years ago, pro-life congressman tried to cajole or whatever word you want, or urged, whichever word you want to use, his mistress to have an abortion. It seems like in a state like Tennessee that it's not necessarily a really close state, if you will, so this may not be the undoing of it unless conservative voters, abortion, big issue for them, decide that he's a hypocrite and don't want to vote for him. Now, of course, you could also say, hey, this is kind of a decade ago, and it's really not news. Catherine, what have you heard about this, and what's your initial thoughts on it?
You know, I've only seen the headlines about it. I haven't looked into it very closely. I guess, you know, it's very, obviously, very hypocritical. But I think that voters might be more as troubled by the urging to get to have an abortion as they would be by the fact that he was having an affair. I mean, shouldn't both of those things be, if you are a, you know, Christian voter with, you know, the ever popular family values, wouldn't both of those bits of information be troubling? And if he did it 12 years ago, if he was having an affair 12 years ago, you know, I think all evidence would lead you to believe that he's probably it wasn't a one-time thing. That in general, we've learned that over the years that, you know, when someone strays, they tend to stray more than once. So, but you know, I'm pro-choice. If his girlfriend wanted to have an abortion, more power to her. If he was, you know, strong-arming her and she didn't want to have one, then that's bad. That's even worse. So, but I doubt it'll have any effect on Tennessee. I mean,
yeah, I don't know, and I don't know where this district is. Is it, you know, part of Metro Nashville? I'm not sure. Certain places in Tennessee vote different than others. As far as one thing, I think, as far as the political scale, this doesn't rise to the David Vitter letter, a level, I should say. You know, there's a very hypocritical congressman that was doing it more like, you know, 12 weeks ago when he faced the voters, not 12 years ago, if you will. So I think that, you know, the time in which it happened does matter, because somebody could say, look, I changed my ways, and somebody might change their ways, and it'd be a decade past figures in. What is this?
Well, you said it was 12 years ago, and I might have changed. He's saying now it's a desperate personal attack dredged up by his opponent, and that's fine and good. But in 2010, this was Lincoln Davis's district, and he beat him. This guy is just completing his first term. And these charges came out then, and he said they were all false. And there was more. Oh, yes, there was more. He had a deal with a gun, you know, brandishing the thing around his ex-wife and stuff like that. So this guy had quite a little one-year deal going there. All of this happened in the space of about a year. And secondly, this man runs as a strong pro-life, you know, anti-abortion guy. Well, it turns out, I mean, he's on the phone. They've got the transcripts of him telling her, you know, strong-arming her to get an abortion, and he doesn't deny that now either. And secondly, he's a doctor.
He's old
as a doctor by dating one of his patients, not to mention he was married. So, yeah, this all should come out. If these people are going to run on moral issues, then they ought to live them too, or not run on them at all. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I know Lincoln Davis's district, that was a swing district for the past few elections.
Yeah.
I'm sure it went through redistricting and became more Republican. You would think that if still voters there, that the whole district, that this may be a problem, and this is the kind of seat that could flip the House back over if they have to worry about this one. So not only does it look bad, it could become a bit of a swing district that they lose, that they probably shouldn't have lost. And this election, okay, things, then maybe they'll learn, just like every party should, and your presidential, or I'm sorry, your primary process, just, you know, find better candidates that won't have type of contradictions in the past. Yeah. Well, I guess this coming up week, we've got another debate. We'll have more polls, and we'll get a, you know, fuller picture if this race is coming back like it was, say, a month ago, not like it was a week ago. And no telling what else we'll have. I know one has to make from Virginia on before the election, and maybe some other swing states. But until then, it's been the Kudzu Fun.
Thanks a lot,
good night,
everybody.
Guys.
Good night.
we are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound.